The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we have a lot to cover. The latest on fluoride, so important is this new piece, that I've put Fluoride, the Deadly Legacy, a very comprehensive article with over 240 scientific references, up on our website so that you can follow up and do a more comprehensive look at the dangers of fluoride. But that's coming at you. Also, junk food. It's not just tasty for a lot of people who are used to it. It's as addictive as street drugs. Also, the latest on iron and folic acid. Then, in many, I'm going to say maybe 2 or 3 minutes each, commentaries on how the USDA is now recommending that we, in the organic movement, coexist with Monsanto. And what do we say? No. Ronnie Cummings' commentary. Obama, A Tale of Betrayal by Rabbi Michael Lerner. Then the 15 dirty big pharmaceutical tricks that rip you off and put your health at risk by Martha Rosenberg of Alternet. Be the Peace You Want to See on Earth by David Swanson. He is my guest today, and we're going to talk about what are the positive signs of progressive resistance and activism against government policies, and what has the government done to curtail our ability to resist. Are we, the independent and progressive minds in America, representing more than 44% of the total American population, Are we the enemy? Are we now on their radar screen? Are we being considered as potentially dangerous to America and its ruling elite? Is anyone they're fighting? Could be. Wait till you hear what they're planning on doing. What Obama, this particular and exclusive president, he didn't start it, but George Bush started it, but what he is now implementing. This man is terrified in his White House. And also, David DeGraw, he says, I will not participate in the journalism of appeasement. What does that mean? So you see, we have a lot of commentaries to share with you that are not being discussed in either the right or left media. We will hear. Let's begin. This is the latest on fluoride, and I hope that you share this information. This is published in the peer-reviewed journal Environmental Health Perspectives, and it confirms that fluoridated water causes brain damage in children. The most recent among 23 other pertaining to fluoride and lower IQ levels, the new study, so strongly proves that fluoride is a dangerous brain-destroying toxin that experts say could be the one that finally ends water fluoridation. Quote, this is the 24th separate study that has found this association, unquote. That's according to Dr. Paul Conant, director of the Fluoride Action Network. Quote, but this study is stronger than the rest because the authors have controlled for key confounding variables and the addition of correlating lower IQ with levels of fluoride in water. The authors found a correlation between lowered IQ and fluoride levels in children's blood, unquote. For the study, researchers evaluated 512 children ages 8 to 13 in two communities. One had higher than average fluoride levels, and the other had lower than average fluoride levels. After accounting for every possible external variable, including lead exposure, iodine deficiency, and other conditions that might affect brain health, the team still found that the number of higher intelligence children in the low fluoride community was 350% higher than the number in the high fluoride community. Quote, in this study, we found a significant I would say 350% is a big significant relationship between fluoride levels and serum in children's IQ. That's according to the study. So for the quackbusters, those completely discredited fools that Jane Brody and the New York Times have repeatedly used as experts, as consumer union, shame on them for using them as experts. For members of Congress and committees using them as experts, they are experts in nothing. And then finally, after years of people being afraid of them, I said, what do you do with a bully? Just walk up and just bam. That's what they did. And guess what? We have won every single lawsuit and show them in court under oath to be not expert in anything that they claim. In fact, read the actual testimony. I will be putting up on my website in the very near future verbatim testimony against Stephen Barrett in his depositions and all the other quackbusters. And then a separate piece is being done now by an outside group on everything that they have said in their writings and how it can be challenged so easily against actual science. But they control Wikipedia, and I would suggest that we boycott Wikipedia. And if you doubt me, that Wikipedia is completely 100% in control by the pharmaceutical giants, go up and look at anyone in the progressive movement at all. Doesn't matter who it is. Take a look and correct something they've said that's in error, and watch how quickly, within seconds, they immediately put it back. That is because of the control they have. And, of course, if you're getting your information off Wikipedia, you're getting misinformation, bias information, and the entire site is corrupt. In any case, they have said that there's nothing wrong with fluoride. They have railed against those of us, myself specifically, who said when I did articles that were always scientific referenced against the danger of fluoride, all nonsense. Well, we are right. They are wrong. We have helped save people from disease and death. And they have precipitated people being reckless in their pursuit of drinking water with fluoride in it and the consequences that may come from that. This is the latest. So this is the final nail in the coffin. There is no longer any debate, nor should there be any more debate on this issue. Fluoride is toxic. Do not drink it. Do not put it in your toothpaste, your mouthwash. And now go up on progressiveradionetwork.com and read Fluoride, the Deadly Legacy, with 240 scientific references showing you why fluoride is toxic. So good. And now they're also investigating what I have also said is dangerous, mercury in our silver fillings. Now, for a lot of people who are raised on junk food, the junk food to them tastes good. It's soft and sweet or salty and crunchy. Here's the latest, and I think it's worth paying some attention to. It's from the Scripps Research Institute. It says the following. Scientists are increasingly become convinced that junk food can be just as physically addictive as street drugs like heroin. Researchers at Rockefeller University have found that foods high in fat and sugar cause the brain to release many of the same pleasure chemicals that produce drug addiction, including cortisol, dopamine, galanin, and serotonin. Over time, regular consumption of junk food can create imbalances in these chemicals, leading us to eat more and more in order to restore normal levels. Quote, they cause us to have more cravings. There are physiological changes. That's according to Rosa Lopez, New York Department of Health. A recent study by researchers at Scripps Research Institute confirmed this long-term effect by feeding rats either a healthy diet plus limited amounts of junk food, or a healthy diet plus unlimited amounts of junk food. And what they found was that the ones that began to binge were on the unlimited amounts of junk foods. So understanding that, then understanding the challenges that we have of getting people off junk foods, it's no different than getting someone off heroin or cocaine, marijuana or alcohol. You have to take a very similar approach. You have to rebalance the brain chemistry, especially with dopamine and serotonin. The B complex can do that. A B6 in particular but also some of the essential fatty acids are very good at rebalancing. And a phosphatidylserine at 500 milligrams, acetyl L-carnitine at 1,000 milligrams, also ginkgo at 200 milligrams two or three times a day, vitamin B6 at 200 milligrams for about a month, and 100 milligrams B-complex. That can help a heroin addict, a drug addict, an alcoholic, and a junk food addict to rebalance chemistry. So then you're able to create those pleasure hormones, but without the junk food and the fat and the sugar. Iron and folic acid, they're directly related to the improved function in children. Now, this is the latest study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It says the following from Medical News, quote, children whose mothers given iron and folic acid while pregnant were found to have higher levels of intelligence, executive function, and fine motor controls. Early iron deficiency has been shown to alter neuroanatomy and metabolism that in turn can stifle typical cognitive development patterns in children. What we need then is to make sure that women who are pregnant have a good quality multiple vitamin with iron and folic acid and B-complex. From Professor Christian of the Johns Hopkins University, quote, micronutrient inadequacy is a critical concern among pregnant women and young children throughout the world. So that means get them their nutrients early. Bad news for some junk food junkies. According to the American, or Journal of the American Dietetic Association, a team led by Amy Anderson, PhD, the University of Maryland, analyzed data on 2,500 participants in a study called the Health, Aging, and Body Composition Study of America. Dietary questionnaires were presented, and then they were asked to put their favorite foods in six different categories, like healthy foods, high-fat dairy products, meat, fried foods, alcohol, breakfast cereals, refined grains, and sweets and desserts. And during the following 10 years, a high percentage of these people died. And those whose diets consisted of healthy foods, characterized by more fruits and vegetables and whole grains and fish, They weren't the ones dying. The ones who were dying were the ones who had the fried foods, the alcohol, the meat, and the sweets. So another study once again confirms the power of the Mediterranean plant-based diet. And that's a good thing that we have more proof. Now, having the proof, as you heard from the last two programs I've shared with you, doesn't mean that the facts or the truth or good science will sway us, especially if we don't want the discomfort of making change. And generally when a person feels uncomfortable making change in any area of their life, they don't want to make change at all. And as a result, they will continue, diabetics will continue taking sugary sweets in, knowing full well they could die or end up with gangrene. People with congestive heart failure will continue to overeat or eat a lot of saturated fatty foods, knowing, once again, that that fluid around the heart can cause them to suffocate and die. So the mere fact that we have a better answer and we have the truth for people is probably only about 10% of what is necessary to get the person to do something. And then once you have the truth, the real effort begins, and that is in behavior modification. Right now, virtually 50% of everything I do in helping people in any area of life deals with behavior modification. If you can't change the behavior and get them to realign with a more honest and accurate assessment, then they stay aligned to their beliefs, and their beliefs are bad. That's what gets them into trouble again, and that's what's going to keep them in trouble. Now, I mentioned a couple weeks ago how beetroot juice was good for you. Well, there's another article in the Journal of Applied Physiology, University of Exeter, and they found out that beetroot juice can help you maintain your bioactive energy at a longer rate. So for those of you who are biking, jogging, power walking, or swimming, you're going to be able to have a longer workout because this increases nitrate and nitric oxide in your blood, and that gives you a better workout. And finally, placebos work without deception. This is from Harvard University, and here's what it says, quote from Harvard. For most of us, the placebo effect is synonymous with the power of positive thinking. It works because you believe you're taking a real drug. But a new study rattles this assumption. Researchers at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Medical Center have found that placebos work even when administered without the seemingly requisite deception. Placebos or dummy pills are typically used in clinical trials as controls for potential new medications, even though they contain no active ingredients. Patients often respond to them. In fact, data on placebos is so compelling that many American physicians, about 50%, secretly give placebos to unsuspecting patients. And because such deception is ethically questionable, they're exploring whether or not the power of placebos can be harnessed honestly and respectfully. To do this, 80 patients suffering from irritable bowel syndrome were divided into two groups. One group, the controls, received no treatment, while the other group received a regimen of placebos, but honestly described saying you're only getting sugar pills, no medicine. And they were asked to take their sugar pills twice a day. Quote, not only did we make it absolutely clear that these were sugar pills with no active ingredients that were made from inert substances, but we actually had placebo printed on the bottle. We told the patients that they didn't have to even believe in the effects. Just take the pills. They did, and guess what? They had a substantial benefit. So what does that mean? What do you think that means? I'd like to hear your point of view on this, and I think it's very important. So even when a person takes something that they're told will not benefit them, they still benefit? That's powerful. Let's pull back for a moment and see this from a broader perspective. What if the body's cells knew that a pharmaceutical drug would be harmful, but knew that a sugar pill would not be? Then why can't we give any of the credit for this to the innate intelligence of the cell to understand what is good and not good? And to understand that, just pull back a little further and look at applied kinesiology. Applied kinesiology is where you are asking the body, where is your problem? And then the body will tell you through a series of muscle testing by weakness or strength, where the pain is and then what you should have and how much you should have of a given therapy. And it must be done by a trained and experienced and sensitive physician, but it works. There's a whole field of kinesiology that has been able to verify this. But it's based upon the cell knowing what it needs and knowing what it doesn't need. So why is it that we should suppose that if we tell the cell, this is not a drug, the cell then would not respond by having to detoxify it and protect your system from the harmful effects of a drug, including, as you know, the side effects of drugs can be liver failure, kidney failure, death, heart attack, and stroke. It is common. So that's one possibility for that. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm Gary Noll. We are going to be talking with Carolee in studio in a moment, but a couple of short commentaries. One of the newest revelations from WikiLeaks is this. I'll quote this. The U.S. should retaliate against European Union for genetically modified resistance. U.S. engineers should force feed Europeans with genetically engineered crops. Quote, country team Paris recommends that we calibrate a target retaliation list that causes some pain across the European Union. That was the U.S. ambassador to France, Craig Stapleton. Now, WikiLeaks labels, cables released over the weekend reveal more about U.S.'s role as a global bully, trying to thrust unpopular genetically modified food crops onto cautious governments and their citizens. So what this says is that they now see using our government and our government agencies to, quote, retaliate and create pain. The world doesn't want genetically modified foods. All over Europe, being far more aware of the importance of foods than Americans, they have said no. But Monsanto says, we want our money. And so they're using the United States agencies, including the State Department, in order to punish them, as they state. So this tells us a lot about the truth behind genetic engineering, the State Department, and what we really think about the people of Europe. Next up, USDA recommends coexistence with Monsanto. Ronnie Cummins from the Organic Consumers Association challenges this. Quote, after 16 years of nonstop biotech bullying and force-feeding genetically engineered or modified crops to farm animals and frankenfoods to unwitting consumers, Monsanto has a big problem, or rather several big problems. A growing number of published scientific studies indicate that genetically modified foods pose serious human health threats. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine recently stated, quote, several animal studies indicate serious health risks associated with genetically modified foods, including infertility, immune problems, accelerated aging, faulty insulin regulation, and changes in major organs and gastrointestinal system. The American Academy of Environmental Medicine advises consumers to avoid genetically modified foods. And before the FDA arbitrarily decided to allow genetically modified organisms into food products in 1994, FDA scientists had repeatedly warned that genetically modified foods can set off serious, hard-to-detect side effects, including allergies, toxins, new diseases, and nutritional problems. Federal judges have finally started to acknowledge what organic farmers and consumers have said all along. Uncontrollable and unpredictable genetically modified organism crops such as alfalfa and sugar beets spread their mutant genes onto organic farms and into non-genetically engineered varieties and plant relatives should be halted. So now the USDA, which is controlled by Monsanto and former employees, all appointed by Obama, says let us coexist. And Ronnie, myself, and others say no. No, unlike this president and others and members of Congress, I don't believe in appeasement. I don't believe that we should cooperate in such a way that it undermines our health. Then who gains by that cooperation? Once again, this notion of risk-benefit ratio. Always in the history of the United States, the risk is 100% on the consumer. The benefit is by those, whether it's cigarettes or sugar or alcohol, pharmaceuticals or genetically engineered organisms. It's always the benefit to the manufacturers. That shouldn't be the way it is. That's the way it is. So say no to genetically modified foods everywhere. And finally, from David DeGraw, he says, I will not participate in the journalism of appeasement. I'll quote this. If we continue to let our politicians and wealthy members of society live in comfort, free of the consequences of their actions, we are complicit in our own demise. Our country is overrun with corruption, we cannot remain passive and expect things to get any better. The economy is propped up by smoke and mirrors, and we inevitably will collapse. Without immediately breaking up the banks and holding the thieves accountable, we will continue on our downward spiral with increasingly severe and devastating consequences. These are extremely unpleasant truths that we are now forced to confront. If we have to act now, we have a chance. But if we do not act, then we do so at our own peril. In response to statements that are appeasing, and I have been exchanging emails with colleagues, journalists, and news editors who have become uncomfortable with my reporting style and been saying some variations of the following, quote, "You're being too radical. This is too extreme for us to publish." Well, while I appreciate their opinions, I want to make something 100% clear. I am fully aware that these words are harsh and may turn off some people. However, in extreme times, telling the truth will make you sound extreme. Ultimately, I don't mind if you think I sound too extreme. I don't care if I make people uncomfortable or if, in your opinion, I become too radical. Try telling that to the 52 million Americans who are now living in poverty. Tell that these words are too harsh to the millions of American families who have lost their homes and jobs. Also, tell it to the 59 million Americans who cannot afford health insurance. Tell it also to the overwhelming majority of the population who are stressed out, living paycheck to paycheck, buried in debt, that they will never get out of, and desperately struggling to make ends meet. Try telling that, these statements are too harsh, to the people who have emailed me explaining their dire situations due to this economic crisis. Tell that to all the people I personally know who have taken major pay cuts. I will not participate in the journalism of appeasement. What has to happen for you to stop being a status quo supporter, naive journalist, and realize that we are in the middle of a war? More accurately, it is a slaughter, an all-time record-breaking slaughter. I refuse to normalize the unthinkable. And here's just a list of the statistics that I'm sure you are already aware of, extremely sick of hearing. 3 million families this year foreclosed upon. 30 million people in need of employment. 43 million people on food stamps. 52 million people in poverty. 59 people without health insurance. 239 million living paycheck to paycheck. $144 billion in Wall Street bonuses. And $13 trillion in invisible invested wealth within 1% of the U.S. population. So ask yourself this question. How sick and depraved of a society do you have to live in to get an outcome like this? David DeGraw. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment.
Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day. For love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starless night. Just in case you feel you want to hold.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. In about 10 minutes, we'll be going to our guest, David Swanson. But now let's go into our studio in New York City. I'm not in the studio. I'm out filming. And say hello to our program director, Kara Lee. Hi, Kara.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, you know, Gary, you know, recently I know there's been a lot going on with S-510 and things happening in the Senate, and I just get phone calls all the time of people who are trying to make it different, and they want to know more about what's going on. And so I thought I would ask you, you know, people in Europe are protesting and, you know, sticking up to the government, and why aren't Americans doing the same? I know we have a lot of very dedicated individuals who listen here, but overall, why do you think people are lacking action?
All right, give me your opinion first.
You know what? I think people here don't know how to respond. They don't know how to react. You know, sometimes calling your senator just doesn't seem like you're doing enough of your own part. So instead of trying to get more involved, people just give up. and they would rather just do things that are easier. So that's my opinion, but, you know, obviously, I think people would really appreciate hearing your side of the story.
Okay, I think we have to pull back a little bit. And first, let's take a look in the United States. But what's happening in the United States can also happen in Europe. We're looking now at what should happen. Which should have happened 30 years ago. We're only seeing the consequences of it now. It's like a person that drinks every day, and then one day wakes up and they got excruciating pain, and their kidneys are failing, and their liver is failing, and they say, "Oh my God, look at this crisis. This was a long time coming. Virtually all of our crisis is a long time coming. Our job losses, our housing wipeout, our 401k wipeouts." This assault actually began in the early 1970s. Do you remember the California? Did you ever hear about the California property tax revolt?
No.
Okay, that was the beginning of a long decline in public services. Next came a recession. Then there was a whole lot of, in the Reagan administration, anti-union policies. It began when he had a confrontation with the air traffic controllers, so he brought in the controllers who were not unionized and took it over. And then it also went into other areas. Now, one time in the United States, we had a very high level of employment in the middle class, and that peaked in 1979. Now, starting in 1979, or a little before and extending after that, in came something unique. Corporate raiders, T. Boone Pickens, Ivan Bosky, Saul Steinberg, Carl Icahn, Michael Milken. These were the top five. They would buy a company, and generally with junk bonds and debt, and then they would strip off its assets, downsize its employees, sell off the valuable parts, keep an astronomical amount of profit. And then if the company went broke, so be it. But then they started getting the idea, why should we pay an American person $20 an hour and then health benefits $30 an hour and have all these EPA regulations, NOSHA regulations, when we can go to Haiti or to Southeast Asia, and there we can make these dresses, T-shirts, sneakers, or any other appliance for, let's say, 50 cents an hour, and no EPA, and no workman's compensation, and no state taxes. We'll share some. We'll pay bribes to the corrupt ruling elite. We'll give them some ownership in the corporation. But then we can import these products back in the United States at far below our competitors. So if a competitor is making a washing machine in Minneapolis, and it's costing them with materials and labor and taxes and everything else $100 for a washing machine, which they then sell for $250 in a Sears Roebuck, we can make that same washing machine for $30, bring it in and sell it, where our total cost, even with imports and all, is $50, and we can sell that machine for $100 and capture the market. And that's what began. So all those people who were unemployed found other work, more often than not, not at the same wages, and more often than not, not always protected by some union contract. So we saw over 30 million Americans have their jobs cut back, but there was no massive unemployment. And so we began this slow but precipitous reduction in our actual manufacturing segment. Now, jobs in the sector went down just since the year 2000 by 6 million in just manufacturing. Those will not come back. Those people will never see that work again in that field. Why? Brazil, India, China, Korea, Indonesia, those are the countries now that are taking our jobs and bringing back the cheap products. Now, in some areas, the people went from let's say, manufacturing into construction. So starting in the about 2000, construction became a major employer. And that was a big boost, and those companies like Lowe's and Home Depot began to see very high profits, became very successful companies. And everywhere you went in America, you had a hard time finding anyone to do any work because everyone was doing work in the construction. Electricians, plumbers, masons, fine craftsmen, finishers, roofers, landscape architects, they were all busy. But since the year 2007, we have now lost 2 million of those jobs in that section of building, and those are not coming back because we now have a glut of houses that are unsold, a glut of houses that are repossessed that haven't gone on the market yet. If all the homes, 5 million homes that are repossessed went on the market, the value of those homes would plummet and all the other homes would plummet. So the banks are intentionally warehousing these. But that's another bubble. That's an astronomical bubble. And you haven't heard this before, have you? Have you heard anywhere that we have a gigantic bubble in foreclosed but not yet resold homes?
No.
The banks are holding them because if you put 5 homes on one block that are repossessed back on the market, you're going to drive down the price of those homes and all the other homes as well. But those will come back in time, one after another. So where's the market for building? It's in the toilet. Also, there was a time when if you were a homeowner, that was a success story. From 1945 to 2005, which is 60 years, we had about a 1 to 3% appreciation per year in the value of your home. Now, that was realistic. But in a period from 2000 to 2007, you would sometimes have a 20 to, believe it or not, 100% increase per year. So some people had a 200, 300, 500% appreciation in the value of their real estate. Completely a bubble, and everyone knew it. People to say they didn't know it was a bubble is stupid. But when that bubble burst, what happened was virtually all the equity that the middle-class Americans had collected was wiped out. The middle class was simply wiped out because their homes were their equity. That was their collateral. That was their ATM machine. Now, manufacturing and construction are really down, and that made the whole economy sink. So what happened was, if you were wealthy, you didn't make your money in construction. You didn't make it in buying homes. You made it in financing. But you didn't want to earn 2% or 3% in a savings account. You didn't want to earn 4% in a T-bill. You didn't want to earn 5% in a bond. No. You wanted hedge funds. You wanted equity partnerships. You wanted in derivatives, because in derivatives you can make 100% profit, 200% profit. In fact, right now, the amount of money in derivative trading is $600 trillion. It boggles the mind. So here's what we have. So listen very carefully. We don't have an economy in America. If you are the upper middle class, that means you are a professional. You're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you're an architect, a CPA. You are at least going to be down maybe anywhere from 10 to 30%, but you still will have a quality of life. The middle class in America today are teachers and civil servants. Now, we have about over 20 million civil servants, and we have a lot of teachers. They are the people who, because of their union contracts or their tenured positions, they will be able to receive amount of income or after they retire their pensions to maintain a middle-class existence. As long as they watch themselves and don't buy what they don't need and don't spend money they don't have, they'll be able to survive fine. Then you have almost everyone else, the working class. Now, the working class today are almost all service, cooks, and truck drivers, and people in the military, and people who work in hospitals and salespeople. That's your working class. That's a service industry. And what that means is that they are struggling. They may be working, but they're struggling. And frequently where at one time in the 1960s, one person would work, one person stayed home and raised the kids, and it was enough. Today, both people have to work, and if you're in the working class, you'll both work. Some may work two jobs and still not pay enough to have it, get enough to live. Then we have our largest single group of people who are struggling, and that's the senior citizens. They're living on Social Security and possibly pensions. If it's Social Security and pensions, it'll prevent poverty. If it's just Social Security, in today's market, it won't prevent poverty. Why? Because when those bubbles in the real estate market went up, so too did property taxes. And therefore, all the local municipalities expanded because they were flush with money. And I remember my neighbor in Florida who was 90, and he only had Social Security. And I remember him telling me the day that he got his mail and his taxes were over $12,000, and he said that he could not pay his taxes and his utilities and food and medicine. He was going to have to sell his home that he lived in for 40 years and move. And that he was not alone. But you don't hear about people like him. You don't hear about all the people surviving just on Social Security or a small pension, and now their 401k has been wiped out. So that's where we're at in the United States today. Now, if you take a look at that, that means that you have about 10 million people who are living in very nice comfort and won't have a problem, but all their money is going to be made on speculation. They are not contributing to a sustainable future. They're not making any more jobs in America. It's all about making money off money. And until such time that we recognize that our formulas for creating jobs in the United States is not what it should be, and we're giving massive subsidies to corporate America, and if we stop the subsidies to corporate America, we could save almost $2 trillion a year. Just $200 billion last year was given to the energy cartels. They don't need it. They're profitable enough. And so that would help a lot of people and would stop this whole stupidity of trying to change Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid that benefits a lot of people. Hope that answers your question.
Thanks so much, Gary.
Let's go now to my guest who's standing by. He is David Swanson. He is one of our most important social and political activists in the liberal progressive movement. And he is the author of some important work, a new book called War is a Lie. And it's a challenge of every argument to justify the wars we are embedded in now. Nice to have you with us today, David.
Great to be here, as always.
David, I'm going to just ask you one long question and roll with it, all right?
Sure.
We are witnessing a wide protest movement across Europe, but that has not worked over here. Why not? Why aren't we protesting in the United States? And especially over the tax breaks to the wealthy, the corruption of the Federal Reserve, giving $3.3 trillion to all those 21,000 separate gifts with zero interest and no collateral and no date for payback to international banks and foreign banks and even McDonald's Corporation. And yet we don't seem to have the resolve as most Americans to challenge this. And yet there are a number of individuals who are calling out what they see as improprieties. What can we do to align with those who are finding the truth and speaking it, and what can we do to wake up those who are still indifferent to the issues?
Well, there are a number of key differences that seem pretty apparent between Europe and here. One is that they have a much better communication system. Many nations in Europe have much more public money devoted in a way that is somewhat shielded from day-to-day political spats in independent media. And public media pushes the news forward in a way that improves the private media outlets. And so there is more awareness in Europe of what people do. When we have rallies in this country with millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people, they can go completely unmentioned in the news. When we have dozens of people getting arrested in dozens of different congressional offices or corporate headquarters or banks in protest, it can go unnoticed by American television and newspaper viewers. So part of the answer is that there is a lot more activism in the United States than we know about, but we fail to tell each other about it and to encourage each other with it because we don't have the communication system outside of good radio shows like this one and good websites. We don't have it where most people still sadly and misguidedly go for their news. We are told every day on our televisions that our opinions are crazy and unpopular and fringe ideas when those same media outlets polls say that we're in the majority. And so we are constantly misinforming ourselves about our weakness and failing to inspire ourselves to greater efforts. Another key difference is that there are institutions still in Europe with some strength outside of the two political parties that we have in this country or the several political parties that they have in many European countries, including labor unions that are much stronger and much more able to act independently. In this country, we have organizations on the right that are massively funded and independent of the Republican Party and pushing everybody to the right, from Fox News to the Chamber of Commerce to all the corporate front groups and tea parties. But on the left, we don't. We don't have that. We have the remnants of a labor movement and other institutions that all make themselves subservient to the Democratic Party, which is deadly for independent organizing. So one obvious solution is to support independent media, and another obvious solution is to support independent activist organizing. One alternative to the Tea Party that's been launched is called the Job Party, and you can go to jobparty.org. Those would be a couple of quick suggestions.
All right. Now let's look at who is protesting in Europe. We have an enormous amount of young people in this country who are being educated, where jobs are not going to be available. They're going to come out with good educations, and they're not going to be able to go into the workplace as we would have 10, 20, 30, and 40 years ago. What should their responsibility be to look at both the Democrats and the Republicans, because they're both at fault here, and say, we're looking at this as a generation who have seen the mistakes of our fathers and mothers and our grandfathers and grandmothers, and we don't want to follow in your footsteps. Take it from there.
Well, I think that would be an appropriate approach for young people to be taking to the society that confronts them. I think it would also be an appropriate approach for older people to be taking on their behalf. I don't think it is strictly the responsibility of young people to fix all of our ongoing mistakes. I think we have that responsibility in equal measure. But I think that it is certainly true, from what I can see from afar, of young people getting active in Europe, that they are doing a far better job, just as they are doing a far better job in California universities and other parts of this country than in the rest of the country. And I think that those efforts need to be seen in order to inspire others to do likewise. I mean, there are students fighting not just for decent tuition costs, but for living wages for staff at universities. And we don't and we don't hear about it. And I think that, you know, we have this experience of 40 years ago of young people getting outraged about a draft for an illegal war, and we've now managed to put in place a poverty draft and avoided that draft and avoided that impact on the slimming group of young people that is able to make it into higher education. But I think that we're going to have to find a way. And environmental groups seem to be doing as good a job as anyone at inspiring young people to activism.
I would agree with that. But my thought is this, David. First off, for every effort that we in the progressive movement make, this and the previous administrations set into motion their black op organizations to classify, photograph, record, monitor, and try to put into categories anyone, anywhere in America, who is protesting anything against the government as aligning with homeland security threats. In effect, this right now in the United States, this may be a little difficult for some people to appreciate, but early 1930s Italy. We're seeing the combination of corporate elite and government coming together to create a plutocracy, not a democracy, but fascism as its tool. So they're taking back the internet, now the FCC is. So we're going to have corporate control of the internet in the next 2 years. And all the while, the people will sit there and not protest. I'm concerned. I believe we need a whole list of candidates to go up against the corporate president. This is the best corporate president in American history, with the possible exception of Bill Clinton. And we need progressives. We need to get some of the people who are articulate, intelligent, uncompromising in principle, cannot be corrupted by what happens in Washington, to go up, if nothing else, even to lose, but to lose where we create a platform so that we now know what we should be focused on and build from there. Your thoughts?
Well, I do think a lot of us know what we should be focused on. It's a question of getting it done. I think that the criminalization of protest and activism that you mentioned, which is very, very real and growing and progressing very rapidly, means that if we do not continue to protest, we will see those rights permanently criminalized. And if we do not communicate what's happening, we will come to believe that everybody else thinks that's okay. And so we have to keep protesting, and we have to keep communicating that to each other, which is why I think, you know, I'm all for primarying Obama and running general election candidates against Obama, and not just to send a message but to win, which I think is an entirely achievable goal, particularly in a 3- or 4-way race, particularly if Obama continues down this disastrous path of alienating all of his previous misguided supporters. But I think that you know, his plan may be to launch a new war, to have a war that's new and fresh and magnificent just before the 2012 election. And I very much hope that he is misguided in that calculation, if in fact there is that calculation. But that remains to be seen. And I think that regardless, our top priority is not to have a better individual there on the throne, but to get rid of the throne and to go back to having an executive who executes the will of the people as represented through our legislature in Washington. And to get anywhere in that direction requires that our top priority be building activist organizations outside of electoral and party politics. I think that if we can move everybody in the direction of peace and justice, we will be better served by whichever faces are on those offices in Washington.
I fully agree with that, and I want to thank you for sharing that. We will continue to support the idea of real democracy against the Democrat and Republican machinery and ideology, and hopefully people will take the chance to read war is a lie. And what I want to do is this. I'm going to invite you back just to talk about the lies of war. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm going to be Sean Hannity. I would hate to think myself being Sean Hannity for any reason, but I'm going to give all of Sean's arguments that he gives, and I've been writing them down by listening to him, because he never allows anyone to get more than a word in edgewise when you call in on his show. And I'm going to ask you to how you would respond to why we have to be in Afghanistan and Iraq, and why we got to support Israel in going in and bombing Iran, and why we got to go in to and do the drones. And I'm going to give you all those questions and give you an opportunity to take your time uninterrupted and share your thoughts, all right?
Excellent. Yeah, sounds terrific. Much better than just preaching to the choir.
Okay.
And if you want to throw the holy wars of World War II and the Civil War and the Revolution in there, those are the questions I do actually get even in progressive groups as I tour the country.
And we will put them all together and invite you back in the next couple of weeks. David Swanson, always nice to speak with you. Thank you for being on.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all very much. If you miss a program, want to re-listen, go to progressiveradionetwork.com. It's there. Have a nice day, everyone.
Far too many of you died. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. See, war is not the answer, for only love.
Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.
Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh.